Rita stopped Eggshell in front of a house and paid a little boy to hold the reins. From the saddlebags, she took a sheaf of new paper, all wrapped up in special wrapping paper that she'd also made. She carried it up the steps and rang the bell. The house had a round tower on the front, lined with bow windows with stained glass inserts above them. And through the windows and the lace curtains, Nell could see, on different stories, crystal chandeliers and fine plates and dark brown wooden bookcases lined with thousands and thousands of books. A parlourmaid let Rita in the door. Through the window, Nell could see Rita putting a calling card on a silver tray held out by the maid. A salver, they called it. The maid carried it back, then emerged a couple of minutes later and directed Rita into the back of the house. Rita didn't come back for half an hour. Nell wished she had the primer to keep her company. She talked to the little boy for a bit. His name was Sam. He lived in the Least Territories, and he put on a suit and took the bus here every morning so that he could hang around on the street holding people's horses and doing other small errands. Nell wondered whether Tequila worked in any of these houses, and whether they might run into her by accident. Her chest always got a tight feeling when she thought of her mother. Rita came out of the house. "Sorry," she said. "I got out as fast as I could, but I had to stay and socialize. Protocol, you know."
"Explain protocol," Nell said. This was how she always talked to the primer.
"At the place we're going, you need to watch your manners. Don't say, explain this or explain that.
Would it impose on your time unduly to provide me with a concise explanation of the term protocol?" Nell said.
Again Rita made that nervous laugh and looked at Nell with an expression that looked like poorly concealed alarm. As they rode down the street, Rita talked about protocol for a little bit. But Nell wasn't really listening, because she was trying to figure out why it was that, all of a sudden, she was capable of scaring grown-ups like Rita. They rode through the most built-up part of town, where the buildings and gardens and statues were all magnificent, and none of the streets were the same. Some were crescents, some were courts, or circles, or ovals, or squares surrounding patches of greenery, and even the long streets turned this way and that. They passed from there into a less built-up area, with many parks and playing fields, and finally pulled up in front of a fancy building with ornate towers, surrounded by a wrought-iron fence and a hedge. Over the door it said, "Miss Matheson's Academy of the Three Graces." Miss Matheson received them in a cozy little room. She was between 800 and 900 years of age, Nell estimated, and drank tea from fancy thimble-sized cups with pictures painted on them. Nell tried to sit up straight and be attentive, emulating certain proper young girls she had read about in the primer, but her eye kept wandering to the contents of the bookshelves, the pictures painted on the tea service, and the painting on the wall above Miss Matheson's head, which depicted three ladies prancing about in a grove in diaphanous attire. "Our roles are filled, the term has already begun, and you have none of the prerequisites. But you come with compelling recommendations," Miss Matheson said, after she had peered lengthily at her small visitor.
"Pardon me, madam, but I do not understand," Nell said.
Miss Matheson smiled, her face blooming into a sunburst of radiating wrinkles. "It is not important. Let us only say that we have made room for you. This institution makes it a practice to accept a small number of students who are not New Atlantan subjects. The propagation of Atlantan memes is central to our mission, as a school and as a society. Unlike some files, which propagate through conversion or through indiscriminate exploitation of the natural biological capacity that is shared, for better or worse, by all persons, we appeal to the rational faculties. All children are born with rational faculties, which want only development. Our academy has recently welcomed several young ladies of extra-Atlantan extraction, and it is our expectation that all will go on to take the oath in due time."
"Pardon me, madam, but which one is Aglaya?" Nell said, looking over Miss Matheson's shoulder at the painting.
"I beg your pardon," Miss Matheson said, and initiated the procedure of turning her head around to look, which at her age was a civil engineering challenge of daunting complexity and duration.
"As the name of your school is the Three Graces, I have ventured to assume that yonder painting depicts the same subject, Nell said, since they look more like graces than furies or fates. I wonder if you would be so kind as to inform me which of the ladies represents Aglaya, or Brilliance.
And the other two are?
Miss Matheson said, speaking out of the side of her mouth, as she had almost got herself turned around by this point.
Euphrasyne, or Joy, and Thalia, or Bloom, Nell said.
Would you care to venture an opinion? Miss Matheson said. The one on the right is carrying flowers, so perhaps she is Thalia.
I would call that a sound assumption.
The one in the middle looks so happy that she must be Euphrasyne, and the one on the left is lit up with rays of sunlight, so perhaps she is Aglaya.
Well, as you can see, none of them is wearing a name tag, and so we must satisfy ourselves with conjecture, Miss Matheson said. But I fail to see any gaps in your reasoning. And no, I don't suppose they are fates or furies.
It's a boarding school, which means many of the pupils live there. But you won't live there, Rita said, because it isn't proper. They were riding Eggshell home through the woods.
Why isn't it proper?
Because you ran away from home, which raises legal problems.
Was it illegal for me to run away?
In some tribes, children are regarded as an economic asset of their parents. So if one file shelters runaways from another file, it has a possible economic impact which is covered under the CEP. Rita looked back at Nell, appraising her coolly. You have a sponsor of sorts in New Atlantis. I don't know who, I don't know why. But it seems that this person cannot take the risk of being the target of CEP legal action. Hence, arrangements have been made for you to stay in Dovetail for now. Now, we know that some of your mother's boyfriends treated you badly, so there is sentiment in Dovetail to take you in, but we can't keep you at the Millstone community, because if we got into a fracas with Protocol, it could sour our relations with our New Atlantis clients. So it's been decided that you will stay with the one person in Dovetail who doesn't have any clients here.
Who's that?
You've met him, Rita said. Constable Moore's house was dimly lit, and so full of old stuff that even Nell had to walk sideways in some places. Long strips of yellowed rice paper, splashed with large Chinese characters and pimpled with red chop marks, hung from a molding that ran around the living room a foot or two beneath the ceiling. Nell followed Rita around a corner into an even smaller, darker, and more crowded room, whose main decoration was a large painting of a furious chap with a Fu Manchu mustache, goatee, and tufts of whiskers sprouting in front of his ears and trailing down below his armpits, wearing elaborate armor and chainmail decorated with lions' faces. Nell stepped away from this fierce picture despite herself, tripped over the drone of a large bagpipe splayed across the floor, and crashed into a large beaten copper bucket of sorts, which made tremendous smashing noises. Blood welled quietly from a smooth cut on the ball of her thumb, and she realized that the bucket was being used as a repository for a collection of old rusty swords of various descriptions.
You're right, Rita said.
She was backlit with blue light coming in through a pair of glass doors. Nell put her thumb in her mouth and picked herself up. The glass doors looked out on Constable Moore's garden, a riot of geraniums, foxtails, wisteria, and corgi droppings. On the other side of a small khaki-colored pool rose a small garden house. Like this one, it was built from blocks of reddish-brown stone and roofed with rough-edged slabs of green-gray slate. Constable Moore himself could be descried behind a screen of somewhat leggy rhododendrons, hard at work with a shovel, continually harassed by the ankle-biting corgis. He was not wearing a shirt, but he was wearing a skirt, a red plaid number. Nell hardly noticed this incongruity, because the corgis heard Rita turning the latch on the glass doors and rushed toward them, yapping, and this drew out the constable himself, who approached them, squinting through the dark glass, and once he was out from behind the roadies, Nell could see that there was something amiss with the flesh of his body. Overall, he was well-proportioned, muscular, rather thick around the middle, and evidently in decent health. But his skin came in two colors, which gave him something of a marbled look. It was as though worms had eaten through his torso, carving out a network of internal passageways
that had later been backfilled with something that didn't quite match. Before she could get a better look, he plucked a shirt from the back of a lawn chair and shrugged it on. Then he subjected the corgis to a minute or so of close-order drill, using a patch of moss-covered flagstones as parade ground, and stringently criticizing their performance in tones loud enough to penetrate through the glass doors. The corgis pretended to listen attentively. At the end of the performance, Constable Moore burst in through the glass doors. "I shall be with you momentarily," he said, and disappeared into a back room for a quarter of an hour. When he returned, he was dressed in a tweed suit and a rough-hewn sweater over a very fine-looking white shirt. The last article looked too thin to prevent the others from being intolerably scratchy, but Constable Moore had reached the age when men can subject their bodies to the worst irritations—whiskey, cigars, woolen clothes, bagpipes—without feeling a thing, or, at least, without letting on. "Sorry to have burst in on you," Rita said, but there was no answer when we rang the bell.
"I don't care," said Constable Moore, not entirely convincingly. "There's a reason why I don't live up there."
He pointed upward, vaguely in the direction of the New Atlantis clave.
"I'm just trying to trace the root system of some infernal vine back to its source. I'm afraid it might be kudzu."
The constable narrowed his eyes as he spoke this word, and Nell, not knowing what kudzu was, supposed that if kudzu were something that could be attacked with the sword, burned, throttled, bludgeoned, or blown up, it would not stand a chance for long in Constable Moore's garden, once, that is, he got round to it.
"Can I interest you in tea, or—" this was directed to Nell, "some hot chocolate?"
"Sounds lovely, but I can't stay," Rita said.
"Then let me see you to the door," Constable Moore said, standing up.
Rita looked a little startled by this abruptness, but in another moment she was gone, riding Eggshell back toward the mill house.
"Nice lady," Constable Moore muttered out in the kitchen. "Fine of her to do what she did for you. Really, a very decent lady. Perhaps not the sort who deals very well with children, especially peculiar children."
"Am I to live here now, sir?" Nell said.
"Out in the garden house," he said, coming into the room with a steaming tray and nodding through the glass windows and across the garden. "Vacant for some time. Cramped for an adult, perfect for a child. The decor of this house," he said, glancing around the room, "is not really suitable for a young one."
"Who is that scary man?" Nell said, pointing to the big painting.
"Guan Di, Emperor Guan, formerly a soldier named Guan Yu. He was never really an emperor, but later on, he became the Chinese god of war, and they gave him the title just to be respectful. Terribly respectful, the Chinese. It's their best and worst feature."
"How could a man become a god?" Nell asked.
"By living in an extremely pragmatic society," said Constable Moore after some thought, and provided no further explanation. "Do you have the book, by the way?"
"Yes, sir."
"You didn't take it through the border?"
"No, sir, as per your instructions."
"That's good. The ability to follow orders is a useful thing, especially if you're living with a chap who's used to giving them."
Seeing that Nell had gotten a terribly serious look on her face, the constable huffed and looked exasperated.
"It doesn't really matter, mind you. You have friends in high places. It's just that we are trying to be discreet."
Constable Moore brought Nell her cup of cocoa. She needed one hand for the saucer and another for the cup, so she took her hand out of her mouth.
"What did you do to your hand?"
"Cut it, sir."
"Let me see that."
The constable took her hand in his and peeled the thumb away from the palm.
"Quite a nice little slash. Looks recent."
"I got it from your swords."
"Ah, yes, swords are that way," the constable said absently, then screwed up his brow and turned back to Nell. "You did not cry," he said, "and you did not complain."
"Did you take all of those swords away from burglars?" Nell said.
"Nope. That would have been relatively easy," Constable Moore said.
He looked at her for a while, pondering.
"Nell, you and I will do just fine together," he said. "Let me get my first aid kit."
Carl Hollywood's activities at the Parnasse. Conversation over a milkshake. Explanation of the media system. Miranda perceives the futility of her quest. Miranda found Carl Hollywood sitting fifth row center in the Parnasse, holding a big sheet of smart foolscap on which he had scrawled blocking diagrams for their next live production. He apparently had it cross-linked to a copy of the script, because as she sidestepped her way down the narrow aisle, she could hear voices rather mechanically reading lines, and as she came closer, she could see the little X's and O's representing the actors moving around on the diagram of the stage that Carl had sketched out. The diagram also included some little arrows along the periphery, all aimed inward. Miranda realized that the arrows must be the little spotlights mounted to the fronts of the balconies, and that Carl Hollywood was programming them. She rolled her head back and forth, trying to loosen up her neck, and looked up at the ceiling. The angels, or muses, or whatever they were all parading around up there, accompanied by a few cherubs. Miranda thought of Nell. She always thought of Nell. The script came to the end of its scene, and Carl paused it.
"You had a question?" he asked a bit absently.
"I've been watching you work from my box."
"Naughty girl. You should be making money for us."
"Where'd you learn to do that stuff?"
"What? Directing plays?"
"No, the technical stuff. Programming the lights and so on." Carl turned around to look at her.
"This may be at odds with your notion of how people learn things," he said, "but I had to teach myself everything. Hardly anyone does live theater anymore, so we have to develop our own technology. I invented all of the software I was just using."
"Did you invent the little spotlights?"
"No. I'm not as good at the nano stuff. A friend of mine in London came up with those. We swap stuff all the time. My media wear for his matter wear."
"Well, I want to buy you dinner somewhere," Miranda said, "and I want you to explain to me how it all works."
"That's rather a tall order," Carl said calmly, "but I accept the invitation." "Okay. Do you want a complete grounding in the whole thing, starting with Turing machines or what?" Carl said pleasantly, humoring her.
Miranda decided not to become indignant. They were in a red vinyl booth at a restaurant near the Bund that supposedly simulated an American diner on the eve of the Kennedy assassination. Chinese hipsters, classic coastal republic types with their expensive haircuts and sharp suits, were lined up on the rotating stools along the lunch counter, sucking on their root beer floats and flashing wicked grins at any young women who came in.
"I guess so," Miranda said.
Carl Hollywood laughed and shook his head.
"I was being facetious. You need to tell me exactly what you want to know. Why are you suddenly taking up an interest in this stuff? Aren't you happy just making a good living from it?"
Miranda sat very still for a moment, hypnotized by the colorful flashing lights on a vintage jukebox.
"This is related to Princess Nell, isn't it?"
Carl said. "Is it that obvious?"
"Yeah. Now, what do you want?"
"I want to know who she is," Miranda said. This was the most guarded way she could put it. She didn't suppose that it would help matters to drag Carl down through the full depth of her emotions.
"You want to backtrace a payer," Carl said.
It sounded terrible when he translated it into that kind of language. Carl sucked powerfully on his milkshake for a bit, his eyes looking over Miranda's shoulder to the traffic on the Bund.
"Princess Nell's a little kid, right?"
"Yes. I would estimate 5 to 7 years old." His eyes swiveled to lock on hers.
"You can tell that?"
"Yes," she said, in tones that warned him not to question it.
"So she's probably not paying the bill anyway. The payer is someone else. You need to backtrace the payer, and then, from there, track down Nell."
Carl broke eye contact again, shook his head, and tried unsuccessfully to whistle through frozen lips.
"Even the first step is impossible."
Miranda was startled. "That seems pretty unequivocal. I expected to hear difficult or expensive, but..."
"Nope. It's impossible. Or maybe," Carl thought about it for a while, "maybe astronomically improbable is a better way of putting it."
Then he looked mildly alarmed as he watched Miranda's expression change.
"You can't just trace the connection backward. That's not how media works."
"How does media work, then?"
"Look out the window. Not toward the Bund. Check out Yunnan Road."
Miranda swiveled her head around to look out the big window, which was partly painted over with colorful Coke ads and descriptions of blue plate specials. Yunnan Road, like all of the other major thoroughfares in Shanghai, was filled, from the shop windows on one side to the shop windows on the other, with people on bicycles and power skates. In many places, the traffic was so dense that greater speed could be attained on foot. A few half-lane vehicles sat motionless, polished boulders in a sluggish brown stream. It was so familiar that Miranda didn't really see anything. What am I looking for? Notice how no one's empty-handed. They're all carrying something. Carl was right. At a minimum, everyone had a small plastic bag with something in it. Many people, such as the bicyclists, carried heavier loads. Now just hold that image in your head for a moment, and think about how to set up a global telecommunications network. Miranda laughed. I don't have any basis for thinking about something like that. Sure you do. Until now, you've been thinking in terms of the telephone system in the old passives. In that system, each transaction had two participants, the two people having the conversation. And they were connected by a wire that ran through a central switchboard. So what are the key features of this system? I don't know. I'm asking you, said Miranda. Number one, only two people or entities can interact. Number two, it uses a dedicated connection that is made and then broken for the purposes of that one conversation. Number three, it is inherently centralized. It can't work unless there is a central switchboard. Okay, I think I'm following you so far. Our media system today, the one that you and I make our livings from, is a descendant of the phone system only insofar as we use it for essentially the same purposes, plus many, many more. But the key point to remember is that it is totally different from the old phone system. The old phone system and its technological cousin, the cable TV system, tanked. It crashed and burned decades ago, and we started virtually from scratch. Why? It worked, didn't it? First of all, we needed to enable interactions between more than one entity. What do I mean by entity? Well, think about the Ractives. Think about first class to Geneva. You're on this train, so are a couple of dozen other people. Some of those people are being racted, so in that case, the entities happen to be human beings. But others, like the waiters and porters, are just software robots. Furthermore, the train is full of props. Jewelry, money, guns, bottles of wine. Each one of those is also a separate piece of software, a separate entity. In the lingo, we call them objects. The train itself is another object, and so is the countryside through which it travels. The countryside is a good example. It happens to be a digital map of France. Where did this map come from? Did the makers of First Class to Geneva send out their own team of surveyors to make a new map of France? No. Of course they didn't. They used existing data, a digital map of the world that is available to any maker of Ractives who needs it, for a price, of course. That digital map is a separate object. It resides in the memory of a computer somewhere. Where exactly? I don't know. Neither does the Ractive itself. It doesn't matter. The data might be in California, might be in Paris, it might be down at the corner, or it might be distributed among all of those places and many more. It doesn't matter, because our media system no longer works like the old system, dedicated wires passing through a central switchboard. It works like that. Carl pointed to the traffic on the street again. So, each person on the street is like an object? Possibly, but a better analogy is that the objects are people like us, sitting in various buildings that front on the street. Suppose that we want to send a message to someone over in Pudong. We write the message down on a piece of paper, and we go to the door and hand it to the first person who goes by and say, "Take this to Mr. Gu in Pudong." And he skates down the street for a while and runs into someone on a bicycle who looks like he might be headed for Pudong and says, "Take this to Mr. Gu." A minute later, that person gets stuck in traffic and hands it off to a pedestrian who can negotiate the snarl a little better, and so on, until eventually it reaches Mr. Gu. When Mr. Gu wants to respond, he sends us a message in the same way. So, there's no way to trace the path taken by a message. Right. And the real situation is even more complicated. The media net was designed from the ground up to provide privacy and security, so that people could use it to transfer money. That's one reason the nation-states collapsed.
As soon as the media grid was up and running, financial transactions could no longer be monitored by governments, and the tax collection systems got foobarred. So, if the old IRS, for example, wasn't able to trace these messages, then there's no way that you'll be able to track down Princess Nell.
Okay. I guess that answers my question, Miranda said.
Good, Carl said brightly.
He was obviously pleased that he'd been able to help Miranda, and so she didn't tell him how his words had really made her feel. She treated it as an acting challenge. Could she fool Carl Hollywood, who was sharper about acting than just about anyone, into thinking that she was fine? Apparently she did. He escorted her back to her flat in a 100-story high-rise just across the river in Pudong, and she held it together long enough to bid him goodbye, get out of her clothes, and run a bath. Then she climbed into the hot water and dissolved in awful, wretched, blubbery, self-pitying tears. Eventually she got it under control. She had to keep this in perspective. She could still interact with Nell, and still did, every day. And if she paid attention, sooner or later she would find some way to penetrate the curtain. Barring that, she was beginning to understand that Nell, whoever she was, had been marked out in some way, and that in time she would become a very important person. Within a few years, Miranda expected to be reading about her in the newspaper. Feeling better, she got out of the bath and climbed into bed, getting a good night's sleep so she'd be ready for her next day of taking care of Nell. General description of life with the constable. His avocations and other peculiarities. A disturbing sight. Nell learns about his past. A conversation over dinner. The garden house had two rooms, one for sleeping and one for playing. The playing room had a set of double doors made of many small windows that opened onto Constable Moore's garden. Nell had been told to be careful with the little windows because they were made of real glass. The glass was bubbly and uneven, like the surface of a pot of water just before it breaks into a boil, and Nell liked to look at things through it because, even though she knew it was not as strong as a common window, it made her feel safer, as though she were hiding behind something. The garden itself was forever trying to draw the little house into it. Many vast-growing vines of ivy, wisteria, and briar rose were deeply engaged in the important project of climbing the walls, using the turtle-shell-colored copper drain pipes and the rough surfaces of the brick and mortar as finger holds. The slate roof of the cottage was phosphorescent with moss. From time to time, Constable Moore would charge into the breach with a pair of trimmers and cut away some of the vines that so prettily framed the view through Nell's glass doors, lest they imprison her. During Nell's second year living in the cottage, she asked the constable if she might have a bit of garden space of her own, and after an early phase of profound shock and misgivings, the constable eventually pulled up a few flagstones, exposing a small plot, and caused one of the dovetail artisans to manufacture some copper window boxes and attached them to the cottage walls. In the plot, Nell planted some carrots, thinking about her friend Peter, who had vanished so long ago, and in the window boxes she planted some geraniums. The primer taught her how to do it, and also reminded her to dig up a carrot sprout every few days and examine it so that she could learn how they grew. Nell learned that if she held the primer above the carrot and stared at a certain page, it would turn into a magic illustration that would grow larger and larger until she could see the tiny little fibers that grew out of the roots and the one-celled organisms clinging to the fibers and the mitochondria inside them. The same trick worked on anything, and she spent many days examining flies' eyes, bread mold, and blood cells that she got out of her own body by pricking her finger. She could also go up on hilltops during cold, clear nights and use the primer to see the rings of Saturn and the moons of Jupiter. Constable Moore continued to work his daily shift at the gatehouse. When he came home in the evening, he and Nell would often dine together inside his house. At first, they got food straight from the MC, or else the constable would fry up something simple like sausage and eggs. During this period, Princess Nell and the other characters in the primer found themselves eating a lot of sausage and eggs, too, until Duck lodged a protest and taught the princess how to cook healthier food. Nell then got in the habit of cooking a healthy meal with salad and vegetables several afternoons a week after she got home from school. There was some grumbling from the constable,
but he always cleaned up his plate and sometimes washed the dishes. The constable spent a lot of time reading books. Nell was welcome to be in his house when he was doing this, as long as she was quiet. Frequently he would shoo her out, and then he would get in touch with some old friend of his over the big mediatron on the wall of his library. Usually Nell would just go back to her little cottage during these times, but sometimes, especially if the moon was full, she would wander around in the garden. This seemed larger than it really was by virtue of being divided into many small compartments. On late full moon nights, her favorite place was a grove of tall green bamboo with some pretty rocks strewn around. She would sit with her back against a rock, read her primer, and occasionally hear sound emanating from the inside of Constable Moore's house as he talked on the mediatron, mostly deep bellowing laughter and explosions of good-natured profanity. For quite some time, she assumed that it was not the constable who was making these sounds, but rather whomever he was talking to, because in her presence the constable was always very polite and reserved, albeit somewhat eccentric. But one night, she heard loud moaning noises coming from his house, and crept down out of the bamboo grove to see what was happening. From her vantage point through the glass doors, she couldn't see the mediatron which was facing away from her. Its light illuminated the whole room, painting the normally warm and cozy space with lurid, flashing colors and throwing long, jagged shadows. Constable Moore had shoved all the furniture and other obstructions to the walls and rolled up the Chinese carpet to expose the floor, which Nell had always assumed was made of oak, like the floor in her cottage. But the floor was, in fact, a large mediatron itself, glowing rather dimly compared to the one on the wall, and displaying a lot of rather high-resolution material, text documents and detailed graphics with the occasional cinefeed. The constable was down on his hands and knees amidst this, bawling like a child, the tears collecting in the shallow saucers of his half-glasses and spattering onto the mediatron, which illuminated them weirdly from below. Nell wanted badly to go in and comfort him, but she was too scared. She stood and watched, frozen in indecision, and realized as she did so that the flashes of light coming from the mediatrons reminded her of explosions, or rather pictures of explosions. She backed away and went back into her little house. Half an hour later, she heard the unearthly noise of Constable Moore's bagpipes emanating from the bamboo grove. In the past, he had occasionally picked them up and made a few squealing noises, but this was the first time she'd heard a formal recital. She was not an expert on the pipes, but she thought he sounded not bad. He was playing a slow number, a coronach, and it was so sad that it almost tore Nell's heart asunder. The sight of the constable weeping helplessly on his hands and knees was not half so sad as the music he was playing now. In time, he moved on to a faster and happier pibroch. Nell emerged from her cottage into the garden. The constable was just a silhouette, slashed into 100 ribbons by the vertical shafts of the bamboo, but when she moved back and forth, some trick of her eye reassembled the image. He was standing in a pool of moonlight. He had changed clothes. Now he was wearing his kilt, and a shirt and a beret that seemed to belong to some sort of a uniform. When his lungs were empty, he would draw in a great breath, his chest would heave, and an array of silvery pins and insignia would glimmer in the moonlight. He had left the doors open. She walked into the house, not bothering to be stealthy because she knew that she could not possibly be heard over the sound of the bagpipe. The wall and the floor were both giant mediatrons, and both had been covered with a profusion of media windows, hundreds and hundreds of separate panes, like a wall on a busy city street where posters and bills have been pasted up in such abundance that they have completely covered the substrate. Some of the panes were only as big as the palm of Nell's hand, and some of them were the size of wall posters. Most of the ones on the floor were windows into written documents, grids of numbers, schematic diagrams, lots of organizational trees, or wonderful maps drawn with breathtaking precision and clarity, with rivers, mountains, and villages labeled in Chinese characters. As Nell surveyed this panorama, she flinched once or twice from the impression that something small was creeping along the floor. But there were no bugs in the room. It was just an illusion created by small fluctuations in the maps and in the rows and columns of numbers. These things were reactive, just like the words in the primer. But, unlike the primer, they were responding not to what Nell did, but, she supposed, to events far away. When she finally raised her gaze from the floor to view the mediatrons lining the walls, she saw that most of the panes there were much larger, and most of them carried cine feeds, and most of these had been frozen. The images were very sharp and clear. Some of them were landscapes, a stretch of rural road, a bridge across a dried-up river, a dusty village with flames bubbling from some of the houses. Some of them were pictures of people, talking headshots of Chinese men wearing dirty uniforms with dark mountains, clouds of dust, or drab green vehicles as backdrops. In one of the cine feeds, a man was lying on the ground, his dusty uniform almost the same color as the dirt. Suddenly, this image moved. The feed had not been frozen like the others. Someone was walking past the camera, a Chinese man in indigo pajamas, decorated with scarlet ribbons tied round his head and his waist, though these had gone brown with grime. When he had passed out of the frame, Nell focused on the other man, the one who was lying in the dust, and she realized for the first time that he did not have a head. Constable Moore must have heard Nell screaming over the sound of his bagpipes, for he was in the room within a few moments, shouting commands to the mediatrons, which all went black and became mere walls and a floor. The only image remaining in the room now was the big painting of Guan Di, the god of war, who glowered down upon them as always. Constable Moore was extremely ill at ease whenever Nell showed any kind of emotion, but he seemed more comfortable with hysteria than he was with, say, an invitation to play house or an attack of the giggles. He picked Nell up, carried her across the room at arm's length, and set her down in a deep leather chair. He left the room for a moment and came back with a large glass of water, then carefully molded her hands around it. "You must breathe deeply and drink water," he was saying, almost sotto voce. He seemed to have been saying it for a long time. She was a little surprised to find that she did not cry forever, though a few aftershocks came along and had to be managed in the same way. She kept trying to say, "I can't stop crying," stabbing the syllables one at a time. The 10th or 11th time she said this, Constable Moore said, "You can't stop crying because you're all fucked up psychologically." He said it in a kind of bored, professional tone that might have sounded cruel, but to Nell it was, for some reason, most reassuring. "What do you mean?" she said finally, when she could speak without her throat going all funny.
"I mean you're a veteran girl, just like me, and you've got scars."
He suddenly ripped his shirt open, buttons flying and bouncing all over the room to reveal his party-colored torso.
"Like I do. The difference is, I know I'm a veteran. You persist in thinking you're just a little girl, like those bloody Vickies you go to school with."
From time to time, perhaps once a year, he would turn down the offer of dinner, put that uniform on, climb onto a horse, and ride off in the direction of the New Atlantis clave. The horse would bring him back in the wee hours of the morning, so drunk he could barely remain in the saddle. Sometimes Nell would help get him into bed, and after he had lapsed into unconsciousness, she could examine his pins and medals and ribbons by candlelight. The ribbons in particular used a fairly elaborate color coding system. But the primer had some pages in the back that were called the Encyclopedia, and by consulting these, Nell was able to establish that Constable Moore was, or at least had used to be, a Brigadier General in the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Division of the 1st Protocol Enforcement Expeditionary Force. One ribbon implied that he had spent some time as an exchange officer in a Nipponese division, but his home division was apparently the 3rd. According to the encyclopedia, the 3rd was often known as the Junkyard Dogs, or simply the Mongrels, because it tended to draw its members from the white diaspora, Aitlanders, Ulster Loyalists, whites from Hong Kong, and rootless sorts from all of the Anglo-American parts of the world. One of the pins on the constable's uniform said that he had graduate-level training in nanotechnological engineering. This was consistent with his belonging to the 2nd Brigade, which specialized in nanotech warfare. The encyclopedia said that it had been formed some 30 years ago to tackle some nasty fighting in Eastern Europe where primitive nanotech weapons were being employed. A couple of years later, the division had been sent off to South China in a panic. Trouble had been brewing there since Zhang Hanhua had gone on his long ride and forced the merchants to kowtow. Zhang had personally liberated several Lao Gai camps where slave laborers were hard at work making trinkets for export to the West, smashing computer display screens with the massive dragon's head grip of his cane, beating the overseers into bloody heaps on the ground. Zhang's investigations of various thriving businesses, mostly in the South, had thrown millions of people out of work. They had gone into the streets and raised hell and been joined by sympathetic units of the People's Liberation Army. The rebellion was eventually put down by PLA units from the north, but the leaders had vanished into the concrete countryside of the Pearl Delta, and so Zhang had been forced to set up a permanent garrison state in the south. The northern troops had kept order crudely but effectively for a few years, until one night an entire division of them, some 15,000 men, was wiped out by an infestation of nanocytes. The leaders of the rebellion emerged from their hiding places, proclaimed the Coastal Republic, and called for protocol enforcement troops to come in and protect them. Colonel Arthur Hornsby Moore, a veteran of the fighting in Eastern Europe, was brought in to command. He had been born in Hong Kong, left as a small child when the Chinese took it over, spent much of his youth wandering around Asia with his parents, and eventually settled in the British Isles. He was picked for the job because he was fluent in Cantonese and not half bad in Mandarin. Looking at the old cine clips in the encyclopedia, Nell could see a younger Constable Moore, the same man with more hair and fewer doubts. The Chinese Civil War began in earnest 3 years later, when the Northerns, who didn't have access to nanotech, started lobbing nukes. Not long afterward, the Muslim nations had finally gotten their act together and overrun much of Xinjiang province, killing some of the Han Chinese population and driving the rest eastward into the maw of the civil war. Colonel Moore suffered an extremely dire infestation of primitive nanocytes and was removed from the action and put on extended convalescent leave. By that time, the truce line between the Celestial Kingdom and the Coastal Republic had been established. Since then, as Nell knew from her studies at the academy, Lao Gui had succeeded Zhang as the northern leader, the leader of the Celestial Kingdom. After a decent interval had passed, he had thoroughly purged all remaining traces of communist ideology, denouncing it as a Western imperialist plot, and proclaimed himself chamberlain to the throneless king. The throneless king was Confucius, and Lao Gui was now the highest ranking of all the mandarins. The encyclopedia did not say much more about Colonel Arthur Hornsby Moore, except that he'd resurfaced as an advisor a few years later during some outbreaks of nanotech terrorism in Germany, and later retired and became a security consultant. In this latter capacity, he had helped to promulgate the concept of defense in depth, around which all modern cities, including Atlanta's Shanghai, were built. Nell cooked the constable an especially nice dinner one Saturday, and when they were finished with dessert, she began to tell him about Harve and Tequila, and Harve's tales of the incomparable Bud, their dear departed father. Suddenly, it was about 3 hours later, and Nell was still telling the constable stories about Mom's boyfriends, and the constable was continuing to listen, reaching up occasionally to fiddle with his white beard, but otherwise displaying an extremely grave and thoughtful countenance. Finally, she got to the part about Bert, and how Nell had tried to kill him with the screwdriver, and how he had chased them down the stairs, and apparently met his demise at the hands of the mysterious round-headed Chinese gentleman. The constable found this extremely interesting, and asked many questions, first about the detailed tactical development of the screwdriver assault, and then about the style of dancing used by the Chinese gentleman, and what he was wearing. "I have been angry at my primer ever since that night," Nell said. "Why?" said the constable, looking surprised, though he was hardly more surprised than Nell herself. Nell had said a remarkable number of things this evening without having ever, to her memory, thought them first. Or at least she didn't believe she had ever thought them before. "I cannot help but feel that it misled me. It made me suppose that killing Bert would be a simple matter and that it would improve my life. But when I tried to put these ideas into practice..." She could not think of what to say next.
"The rest of your life happened," the constable said. "Girl, you must admit that your life with Bert dead has been an improvement on your life with Bert alive.
Yes.
So the primer was correct on that point. Now, as the fact that killing people is a more complicated business in practice than in theory, I will certainly concede your point. But I think it is not likely to be the only instance in which real life turns out to be more complicated than what you've seen in the book. This is the lesson of the screwdriver, and you would do well to remember it. All it amounts to is that you must be ready to learn from sources other than your magic book.
But of what use is the book, then?
I suspect it is very useful. You want only the knack of translating its lessons into the real world. For example, the constable said, plucking his napkin from his lap and crushing it into the tabletop. Let us take something very concrete, such as beating the bejesus out of people. He stood up and tromped out into the garden. Nell ran after him. I have seen you doing your martial arts exercises, he said, switching to a peremptory outdoor voice and addressing the troops' voice. Martial arts means beating the bejesus out of people. Now, let us see you try your luck with me. Negotiations ensued as Nell endeavored to establish whether the constable was serious. This being accomplished, she sat down on the flagstones and began getting her shoes off. The constable watched her with raised eyebrows.
"Och, that's very formidable," he said. "All evildoers had best be on the lookout for little Nell, unless she happens to be wearing her bloody shoes."
Nell did a couple of stretching exercises, ignoring more derisive commentary from the constable. She bowed to him, and he waved his hand at her dismissively. She got set into the stance that Dojo had taught her. In response, the constable moved his feet about an inch further apart than they had been and pooched his belly out, which was, apparently, the chosen stance of some mysterious Scottish fighting technique. Nothing happened for a long time except for a lot of dancing around. Nell danced, that is, and the constable blundered around desultorily.
"What's this?" he said. "All you know is the fence."
"Mostly, sir," Nell said. "I do not suppose it was the primer's intention to teach me how to assault people."
"Och, what good is that?" the constable sneered,
and suddenly he reached out and grabbed Nell by the hair, not hard enough to hurt. He held her for a few moments and then let her go.
"Thus endeth the first lesson," he said.
"You think that I should cut my hair off?"
The constable looked terribly disappointed.
"Oh, no," he said. "Never, ever, ever cut your hair off. If I grabbed you by the wrist," and he did, "would you cut your arm off?"
"No, sir."
"Did the primer teach you that people would pull your hair?"
"No, sir."
"Did it teach you that your mother's boyfriends would beat you up and your mother not protect you?"
"No, sir, except insofar as it told me stories about people who did evil."
"People doing evil is a good lesson. What you saw in there a few weeks ago," and by this Nell knew he was referring to the headless soldier on the Mediatron, "is one application of that lesson, but it's too obvious to be of any good." "Ah, but your mother not protecting you from boyfriends, that has some subtlety, doesn't it?"
"Nell," the constable continued, indicating through his tone of voice that the lesson was concluding, "the difference between ignorant and educated people is that the latter know more facts. But that has nothing to do with whether they are stupid or intelligent. The difference between stupid and intelligent people, and this is true whether or not they are well educated, is that intelligent people can handle subtlety. They are not baffled by ambiguous or even contradictory situations. In fact, they expect them, and are apt to become suspicious when things seem overly straightforward. In your primer, you have a resource that will make you highly educated, but it will never make you intelligent. That comes from life. Your life up to this point has given you all of the experiences you need to be intelligent, but you have to think about those experiences. If you don't think about them, you'll be psychologically unwell. If you do think about them, you will become not merely educated, but intelligent. And then, a few years down the road, you will probably give me cause to wish I were several decades younger." The constable turned and walked back into the house, leaving Nell alone in the garden, pondering the meaning of that last statement. She supposed it was the sort of thing she might understand later, when she had become intelligent.